And then, yeah, worked in a couple of places, mainly the cereal cafe. I have a very in-depth knowledge of breakfast cereals. On this stage, I never played out with the TM passing me guitars I'd never met. Like, there were so many, like, parts about it that shouldn't have been comfortable, and yet it was, like, incredibly comfortable. And one of those moments where I'm like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. You know, I think being unsigned or being kind of DIY or, like, very hands-on with your own project, like, there comes a point where it is choice, and I would definitely keep choosing it.
Hello and welcome back to Noisy and Outspoken, the podcast. I'm actually recording the intro to this episode in my car, which I feel like is just an amusing little fact that you should know before listening to this episode. In today's episode, I'm chatting with Orla Gartland, who released her debut album, Woman on the Internet, last August, and it charted at number 10. Orla is an absolute all-round legend. We've known each other since 2019, and we talk all about our friendship and how we started working together. As this episode is being released, I'm actually on tour with her in Europe, so if you're hanging out in a city near us, please come hang out at the shows. It'd be lovely to see you. Orla is an independent artist, and in this episode we talk quite a lot about what it's like to work completely as an independent artist without a label, what it was like releasing an album without a label, and more. I hope you absolutely love this episode. We also talk quite a lot about touring. At the time this episode was recording, she was away with Dodie on a US run of shows and had been for about 6 weeks. There is a lot in this episode, and I really hope you can take something away from this if you are an independent artist or you're wanting to get into a position like Orla. I hope you enjoy. Hello, Orla. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. To anyone listening, if you think my audio sounds echoey, I've just moved studio and I'm very aware that there's quite a big space next to me with nothing in it. So it probably sounds horrific. If so, I'm really sorry. But yeah, thank you for joining me. Where are you today? You're currently on tour with Dodie, and where are you?
Currently on a US tour with Dodie. We are in, I would call it New Orleans, but I've heard everyone else call it New Orleans.
Ah, I've heard New Orleans, so maybe that's why I was like, where the hell are you?
Yeah, I was doing like a long E, but yeah, we're in New Orleans for the first of 3 days off, which is quite rare on a tour.
Oh, you're gonna have the best time. Have a little bit of sunshine.
It's so hot. It's so hot and sticky. It's really bizarre. So yeah.
Okay, I can confirm to you it's not hot and sticky in the UK. I think it's no hotter than 9 degrees. Very windy and a lot of spitty rain.
Oh.
So I'm very jealous, basically. It's not like that here at all.
Oh.
Not at all.
I'll do my best not to flex.
Please don't. So obviously I tend to, on the podcast, like do an intro as to how we know each other. So we first met in 2019. I did a show for you at Omira in London. Up until recently, I still had the sticky that I had shooting that gig on my laptop, but I got a new laptop, so RIP to the sticky. But before that, I mean, I've, as I said to you before this, I've listened to your music for years and years and years, and then I shot that show and I was like, wow, these people are human. It was in the period where I was like, musicians aren't actually real, they're just
abstract figures.
And then I began to realize that, yeah, I was like, oh, they're actually our people. And then after that, I don't really think our paths crossed. And then COVID happened. And then our paths next crossed in real life. I remember I sent you a video when I was sat in my car, and I can't remember what song it was now, which is really bad, but I was listening to Radio 1 and it was the morning and one of your tracks was being played, and I sent a video and sent it to you, and I was like, oh my god, this is so cool. And then after that, the last time we actually met in real life was at Latitude in 2021. I came and shot your set because I remembered you were playing and I was so excited, and I came up to you afterwards and you were like, I thought it was you. After that, I then came on tour with you and did your UK run of shows. Yes. After your album came out, which was the best time. And here we are, now recording a podcast.
We've had so many like pivotal moments together. Now that I think about it, that Latitude show was like, you saw us all after. We were like such a mess. I was crying so hard.
It was like one of those moments, I think, because none of us had had, and I felt the same being a photographer at that event, none of us had had live music in that capacity for so long, and it just felt like the most surreal thing to be one amongst it and just two in a crowd, and it was safe. Yeah. And after being in like this thing which was deemed unsafe for so long, it was just the weirdest weekend.
It was so bizarre. I actually felt like the bar was so incredibly low for what people would love, that I could have got up and like whistled for 45 minutes and people would have like lost their shit. Like, the atmosphere was so amazing, And I had also built up, I remember, like about 2 full years worth of, like, I wouldn't call it performance anxieties, but you know that like touring and live music is so chaotic, and like anything that can go wrong will go wrong at some point. And I had built up 2 years worth of like that, because if you're not just like out and about and doing it, you kind of like, you lose a little bit of your resilience and your ability to recover from like your guitar string breaking or like forgetting a very vital cable and all this kind of boring stuff.
Yeah.
And I just remember like building up so much of that, and having Neil, which is our like our TM that we met that day for the first time, and it was just so many new things and I was so overwhelmed. And then I got through the set but felt like I played the set with like a train coming at me the whole time. I felt like I was so on edge. I remember Pete, who plays bass and MDs my show, who is so able musically to do anything, and all he has to do at the beginning of the show is this song called Pretending Starts, and all he has to do is hit one note on his keyboard, and he came out and I saw his hand was like this, it was like shaking, and I was just like, oh my god, there's so much like nervous energy between us. And then as soon as the set finished, I just cried my eyes out.
It was such a good set, and it was one of those things that I was like, I'm so glad I got to witness that first setback. And I think after then seeing you like 2 years previously and seeing the growth as well of like what you'd done musically, and then knowing the album was going to come out like imminently, and like following you online, and also just like I've always thought you're fucking great, and then seeing this show and being like, they've come on so far, and it was so exciting. And then I've told this story before, and I don't know if you remember, but I distinctly remember, I think it was that evening, I'd said goodbye to you all at that set, and then I went off to do my thing, and it was 2 a.m. and I'd just finished shooting some random DJ set. I'd been randomly shooting this DJ set, and I came back and I was like, I'm gonna have a shower. So we were camped in guest camping. I'm gonna have a shower because I wanna be clean when I wake up. And I walked over to the shower cubicles and I heard this woman shrieking, who was shouting like, Emma! I'm obviously not an Emma, but I realized that the woman shrieking was my dear, dear friend Sarah looking for her sister Emma. We used to got there chatting. I just had a shower. We were just stood there chatting. And then about, I don't know, 5 minutes later, you walk past, and then we get chatting, and it was just, again, about 2 a.m. outside these toilet cubicles, to realise that I'm actually not wearing any trousers, and I'm literally only wearing an oversized sweatshirt and my purple, very distinct purple Crocs. And I was like, wow.
Wow.
If that's not memorable, what is?
I was so scared that that woman was going to be me when you described that story, because I was just like, I had a proper party that night, so I was like, oh my god, did I shriek the wrong name at you? It could have been.
No. And I just remember being like, Jesus. And then when you actually asked me to then come on tour, I was like, I really hope she forgot that memory, because that's really bad, and or she remembers it distinctly.
I do remember, and that did not put me off you at all.
Oh, great. So good to know. I was just wearing a David Attenborough sweatshirt and purple Crocs. What a memory.
Iconic. Sounds iconic.
Absolutely iconic. So going back to you, obviously you released your debut album in 2021. It was a top 10 album. It's a great album. If you haven't heard it, you should go listen to it. And obviously you also session and play in Dodie's band.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe before you released the album, you were also the support act for Dodie's tours. So did you do both? I've always wondered this.
Yeah, there was one tour where I did both, just one. I think it was a European run. So it wasn't like the rule. I'd been on five or six Dodie tours, and just one of them we did the support as well, which was a lot of work. It was insane, actually, but it was really fun. I felt the most useful I've ever felt.
Just being like, I'm so busy, I've got all these things to do. But also, also we were discussing this before recording. I feel like touring is like both mentally and physically exhausting, but also this ridiculous high and low that you get, which it's really hard to explain to anyone who has never done it. And I haven't done an insane amount myself, but the stuff I have done, I've really felt that high-low experience. I'd imagine then doing two sets, you just must feel all over the place.
Yeah, your adrenaline is like so strange. Like, I realized it on this tour again, but one of the weirdest things about touring in any capacity is just conservation of energy, because you're having to be your most alert and with it and able at like 10 p.m. every night, which is already weird. And even with a Dodi set, which is a relatively chilled out, beautiful, ethereal, folky experience, we're so pumped, full of adrenaline every night that, like, if you want to get to bed any sooner than 2, just, like, good luck. It's not going to happen for you. And so then your kind of body clock is weird and you're waking up much later than you usually would. You can't really hold yourself to like quite the same standards. But yeah, on the tour where we did both, I was getting the like adrenaline come up of like my set, which is like 30 or 40 minutes long. And then immediately like me and Pete would just like change clothes and get ready to do Dodi's set, which was another completely different conservation of energy that starts off much more chilled and it does pick up, but right at the end. So you're kind of having to like stifle your buzz like quite deliberately. And that's almost more exhausting than the traveling and the moving around, because you kind of get used to that. But yeah, I remember that just being like so crazy.
Yeah, I was going to say part of this I wanted to talk about was, to anyone who wants to be a touring musician, what does a day in the life on the particular run that you're on now look like? Because I know when we were on tour, we weren't on a tour bus, and you're now on a tour bus tour. That is the best way to explain it to anyone who doesn't tour, of the difference of what a tour is. So yes. What does a day in the life of your current touring situation look like?
Yeah, so the difference in how you travel does dictate so much of it. So yeah, we're traveling around in a splitter van for my run, and that's still the case with the tours that I do this year. And if you've got anything under sort of 6-7 people, that's usually the move to get a splitter van, maybe a trailer. And really the main difference is when you do the drives. So when you're in a splitter van, obviously you can't sleep in a splitter van, not properly, not overnight. So when we did our tour, you'd wake up in hotels and get up sometimes at some ungodly hour, and then you would do the drive before the load in. And so the first half of your day you're basically sat in the van. Whereas with the sleeper bus thing, which is what we're doing with Dodi's run, so anytime you kind of cross over into having any more than 7, maybe 8 people, and also you're touring like a lot of backline and production, which is a huge thing with Dodi. So we have a sleeper bus, a trailer for merch, and a truck. And in the truck is lights, big old sign with Dodi's name on it. So it, actually that's a lot of the bulk as well, is the just more people. And the difference there that's massive is you do the drives overnight. So the hotel days are like basically just days off, and you are sometimes doing 4-hour drives, 5 up to like 8, 9, 10 when you sleep. Your bunk is moving in the little coffin bunks. They're really unglamorous. But I also haven't done a huge amount of bus tours, so the novelty of like being on the bus is still there for me.
Yeah, 100%.
I think people who are a bit more like jaded and road worn are not as excited. I still hold a little bit of like giddiness about the whole thing. And it's surprising how just having like the only thing consistent that I have for this 2-month run is my bunk. But at least it's my bunk. It's not my room.
Yeah.
But at least it's my bunk, and I like know that my charger's there and my pajamas are under the pillow. So like even that consistency is like kind of nice. But yeah, day in the life of a show day would be, I probably wake up at about 10. We're usually already at the venue by then. You park up beside the venue, you get power from the venue, so you're usually like around the back or something. The crew are usually loading in at that point, sometime between 10 and 11. And essentially the band has for the first half of the day to do whatever they want to do. And that's like a huge difference as well. So we don't soundcheck till about 4:30. Between 10, 11 and like 4:30, I usually crawl into the venue for a shower, which is like also really unglamorous and horrible.
Very glamorous. I was gonna say this really ticks off all the glamour that everyone thinks the music industry is.
Yeah, I've showered in like some god awful rooms, and it's so funny, like we're at a level of venue now, like some of these venues are like 2,000-3,000 people, and you just think that the backstage facility is going to be like really beautiful, and they're just so rarely are. They're usually like quite old buildings and creaky cold showers with like some other band's hair in them.
I wonder if you've come across any famous hair particles in your time. I reckon you have.
I always think that when I look at the drain, who has been here before? Should I be saving this somewhere? So yeah, crawl in there, and then I usually take like a little bit of time to myself, like very deliberately try and find somewhere for coffee that's like separate to the group, do some admin, keep on top of my project, speak to my manager, make sure I'm like nurturing that as well as, you know, being present on this. That's like a bit of a balancing act to find. So I'll usually take a couple hours to myself, and then you'll just eat either out and about or rider at the venue. And from soundcheck onwards, the day's pretty much all look the same. So do the sound check, takes about an hour, 40 minutes. Eat dinner somewhere in between. Supports, be it doors 7, support 8, us 9 usually. Play for about hour 15. And yeah, just pack up, put everything on the bus. Bus call will depend on when we need to leave for the drive. And like I said, then yeah, it's about like either like leaning into the buzz and like having a few drinks and like staying up with everyone, or what I've been trying to do on this run, be very sensible, try and taper my energy very deliberately, have a tea and not a beer, crawl into my bunk, watch some Netflix, like do whatever I can to try and like switch off the brain.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to say, is that like it can be incredibly like overstimulating and overwhelming, and where you are playing shows that are late in the evening and you're still around like everyone and the buzz, especially if it's a good show and like the buzz is there, it's very hard to be like, right, I know I need to like go have my alone time because I'm gonna really feel it tomorrow if I don't. And it's something that I know I can't be around people for too long, because I'm like a very people person, but I get to a point that I'm like, I just need a little bit of my own time. And trying to find that sometimes, even though you know it's the best thing for you, is still really hard.
Totally. Yeah, your like social battery is interesting on tour, because I love being around people, but it's like I think I recharge when I'm by myself, so I need to be a bit antisocial sometimes and like deal with the FOMO if everyone's like going out and having like a sightseeing morning, because I'm like, that sounds really fun, but I just know for my own sanity that I need to like be on my own for a while. So tapping into that, and it's really interesting, there's a couple people on this run, some new faces on this crew that have never really toured before, definitely not a tour of this length, and I can see them now at this point, they're about halfway through, they're starting to like separate themselves, like listen to their body a bit more, like go for walks. But at the beginning, yeah, they just like, they want to be like up drinking with everyone. And like, I used to be like that back in my day.
Yeah, because you're so old.
I know. Yeah, it makes me sound really old. I do pick my moments with that. I love everyone on this tour so much, and I could talk to them for hours. Like, it's such a fun vibe socially. So yeah, I definitely like pick my moments with it, but I just can't do that every night, or I'm just gonna be so tired, and then I'm not gonna play a good show the next day. So yeah, a lot of it is just having to be really boring, but it's not inherently boring.
Yeah, no, I think it's totally fair. Do you find it hard then to balance the element of what you were saying as how you have to like nurture your relationship with Claire and like make sure that your own project is functioning, then doing a tour of 2 months across America? That must be pretty hard to then keep up the same level of, oh, I do have my own project still and I've got to keep that going. And I know Patreon is a massive part of like how you're an independent artist. Mm-hmm. It must be particularly hard to then keep that going when you're then on a tour of 2 months across America.
Yeah, I found it challenging this tour, definitely. I also know, I guess I know, I'm in a good point with my project where for the first time ever, I've had a body of work out that is like a big chunky 12 song thing, and I've never really had that before. Like, I've had for the years previous, I felt like I was in this like cycle of EPs where it's such a small amount of music that by the time you put it out, you just like have to be moving on to the next one, you have to be writing the next one, you have to be one step ahead. Now I feel like, actually in this day and age, I feel like people do that with albums as well, but I'm trying to remind myself that I don't have to be super active with releasing music this year, because there are certain things like keeping on top of admin. And I've done, like, I did an Apple Music session that was just an acoustic thing I could record on my own. That was possible to do. And yeah, like, certain things are fine to do, but like finding space to write and actually be like genuinely creative is definitely hard. I often find that the days where there is an extra dressing room for me to set my music stuff up are like the days where I just like don't really feel like it. They like rarely like align with when I'm feeling inspired. And there'll be some days where I'm like, oh, I've got this really good idea and I want to put it down, and I'm like, oh, there's one dressing room between 12 of us, like, yeah, where am I gonna do this? So yeah, there's kind of the randomness of it can be like hard, but you know, it's just like a balance to find. And it's also like, just I think being in Dodie's camp is a different part of my brain to use, and it seems like it's disconnected from my project, but it also like really helps because I'm getting to be part of like someone else's live show and like learn what works and like get more comfortable on stage in an arena where the focus isn't on me.
Yeah.
All of that helps when it crosses back over, like going on my April run or the Irish shows that we'll do. Like, I think the lack of nerves and the like recovery time from making mistakes and like all of that will carry over to me from the Doty thing. So sometimes they feel very detached and in conflict, just like only so many hours in the day. And then other times they feel like they can be symbiotic and like help each other. And it's also really nice to be doing something that isn't all about me. I find it so like self-involved. The artist thing is so like, when I was releasing the album and like all of the lead up to it last year, I was just like, I personally felt like I was insufferable to be around, because I was just like always in the middle of making a music video. I was always like trying to plan some merch, and I was just getting into these rabbit holes and like talking the ear off everyone about like thread counts on t-shirt. I just get so like obsessive about anything I'm working on, and it's just not nice to be around sometimes.
That's so interesting that you said that, because I think I was talking about this literally with someone yesterday. I was on a shoot and we were talking about social media and how social media plays such a big part in every artist's profile, and particularly in the day and age that we're in at the moment. Like, obviously everything has to be posted online, and if you're not sharing what you're doing or sharing your making a music video or making whatever, you're not doing anything. And I think then saying what you've just said of that, like, it takes away the stress of it being all about you and you're able to focus on something else and then come back to yours. I actually think there's something really important in that, because actually a lot of the time I think people put too much pressure and stress on the thing that they love so much, because obviously it's your baby.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, taking like a little bit of a step away from it and knowing that it will still be there, but knowing you're working on something else which is equally sick, is possibly like a good thing for your brain too.
I think it's good. It's like humbling, and it keeps me in check from just becoming, I don't know, I think it's actually genuinely hard to have an artist project and not become just like so egotistical and annoying.
Yeah.
And I just like don't want to be that, like that, if you, especially when it's like a solo project, it's under my name. It's just like, I know so many artists, I'm friends with so many artists, and like I catch myself and them in these like feedback loops of just like obsessively thinking and talking about their next move, and it's just hard to be around. It's actually hard to just not become a bit self-involved, because it's an inherently self-involved job. You're talking about yourself all the time.
Yeah.
You're writing songs about yourself all the time. You're thinking about how you present visually all the time. And so that's another thing I really like about the Doty thing, where I just like, I have like my role to play in this, and it's just a cog in a bigger machine, and if I do my part well and everyone else does their part well, the whole thing goes well. But it's not about me, really. I'm just like, I'm at the back with four other people on the riser, and I'm just there to like lift Doty up and like support her thing, and you know, and I'm more than happy to do that. There's been like, it's been nice, but also like I hate it. Like, there's been a couple of shows when we dipped into Florida, people just got really loud and vocal, and just like, they were just the craziest crowds I've ever seen. A lot of the time when there's like a gap, they just can't help themselves with just like screaming so loud. Like, if there's a gap in the song, they're just like, ah, they just they're just shameless about it. And there was a lot of times in the last few days where like in between the like a really quiet song, someone would be like, Orla, I love your music or something. And I literally just look at the floor, and it's probably like, it probably comes across quite rude, but I'm just like, this is not about me. I'm not even going to acknowledge you, because this isn't Doty's show. Don't even look at me. I am not me right now. And obviously everyone in this camp is very like supportive of my thing. It's not like everyone ignores that I have my own project, but I feel very passionately about being like not,
yeah, completely
milking that or trying to take advantage of Doty's platform at all. So
I think that's fascinating, because mm-hmm. I think so much of it is this very self-involvedness, and for you just to be like, look, I'm focusing on this thing I'm doing right now. I've always thought you're a very humble person. You're just a nice person to be around. Like, you've always come across like that. You're very easy to be around.
Oh.
There's nothing about you which strikes you as like I've met quite a few arrogant and not nice artists in the past, and nothing about you is that. And I think because of that, it's really important that you say like, look, I just don't acknowledge if someone like heckles me in someone else's show, because it's not about me. And maybe you wouldn't think like that, or maybe they would, I don't know. I think that's fascinating. It's super, super interesting.
Yeah, no, I think for me it's just second nature. Don't get me wrong, like I'm not like Mother Teresa. Like,
yeah, of course you are.
I am an artist at the end of the day.
I love
the attention in the right setting. I love a compliment in the right setting, but I just think that's like just not,
in the middle of someone else's set, probably not. It's not the right time.
No.
So interesting. But obviously you're Irish. you moved to London for music, and I remember you saying to me that like your parents were so scared that you were moving to London to pursue your musical career. And then I remember you saying as well you worked in like a bunch of coffee shops and did music on the side, and you know, then it became more of a bigger thing, and then you met Claire, and like that's how the story unfolded, I guess. What was that like for you, moving somewhere completely new?
Yeah, it's so funny, like now I feel like that sounds really like big and brave, and even I'm like past tense, I'm like, wow, like go you. But like at the time, I think there's something about being that age that is just like so fearless, and I would just didn't think it was weird at all. I knew like one person, which was Lauren, who's my housemate now and like best friend. I hadn't met Gret or Dodie or anyone else yet. And it just felt like very second nature. Like there's no shortage in Ireland of like creative types and writers and artists, but there's not a lot of infrastructure. There's not a lot of like industry. No managers or like publishers. There is communities, I think, and it's so much better now than it was. But yeah, to me, it just felt like kind of a no-brainer. So it didn't feel like that big a deal at the beginning. And I felt like my first few years in London were like, I kind of gave myself the uni experience. Like I basically lived in like such a horrible flat. It might as well have been just like some halls. Like it was awful. I had like next to no money, but just was so open to making friends, so open to meeting people, play any gig I was given. Like it was just this like openness, and yeah, I felt like my version of that, but it was also like so much stumbling and falling and figuring out what I wanted from music and still being like one foot in, one foot out, not sure if I can do this and fully commit and make a proper go of it. And then, yeah, worked in a couple of places, mainly the cereal cafe.
Really? I didn't know you worked there. Interesting.
Yeah. I have a very in-depth knowledge of breakfast cereals.
That's so funny. If I ever need any recommendations, although I won't because of the gluten-freeness of my life, but if anyone else ever has any need for cereal recommendations, I'll come to you.
There's some great gluten-free cereal. I mean, the stuff there was so sugary in American, like I just would not even want it. But Cocoa Pebbles, Rainbow Pebbles, they're like these really horrible sugary American things, but they were gluten-free. There was a couple of like,
oh, there you go.
I think Reese's Puffs are gluten-free.
Fantastic information.
It's all coming back to me now. But it was crazy because working there felt in one way like very detached from what I do now. But basically I hadn't really done many like real jobs before working there, and I told them I would organize gigs in the cafe, but I was completely bluffing. I had just needed the job so badly. So when they were just like looking at my like terrible CV, they were like, why would we hire you? And I was like, oh, I'm gonna organize some gigs in the cafe. And then got away with like a full year of not doing that, and then they were like, hey, how about those gigs? Probably didn't organize that many, maybe 9 or 10, but like organized these kind of so far-esque like nights, you know, acoustic. Like their venue in Camden is actually really big. You can fit like 100 people in there, and the whole place is really like, it came under so much scrutiny, but I always thought it was quite cool. It's like 90s memorabilia everywhere, and they put so much care into like eBay kind of searching for all that stuff. So when you took it out of the like the cereal thing, it was actually just like quite a cool room. And I think I played a set. I got Lauren, I got like all, I think Maisie played a set.
Crazy. That's Maisie Peters to anyone listening to this.
Yeah, Maisie played a set. And so yeah, I was just kind of pulling it together and acting as a middleman between like artists and the cafe. And then we put on Dodie's first headline shows.
That's so mad. What the hell?
Because she had done lots of tours and shows with other people. But like, you know, with the online thing, it's kind of hard to know sometimes like whether that will translate. And so this felt like a really kind of safe space for them to explore that and just do a couple of acoustic shows, very low pressure. And she just started selling them all out. We did five shows with her in a row. And the last one, we did it outside in Camden Market. Basically, there's like two levels of it, and there's like some steps down to kind of a lower bit, which is where the cafe was, the bit where they have their tables. And so the last gig we did with Dodie was like 300 people sat almost like a little mini amphitheater. And that's when Dodie met Pete, because Pete was just like my friend who had a PA.
That's so random.
It's so weird. So then after, yeah, it was like very clear that Dodie was gonna want to have a band at some point and like really go for it. And then I was like, Pete, you got to get in there. And then when he was putting the band together, he asked if I wanted to do it because I had introduced them. And I was like, I'm not really a guitarist. And he was like, oh, I think you could do it. You know, like, I think you could do it.
That's so lush. I've never heard that as a story. I did wonder like how you all met. If it's through something as nice as I put on gigs at the cereal cafe in Camden, that's really quite sweet.
Yeah, it was actually really sweet. And I actually loved like, you know, I think a lot about like creative people who don't, would like to do more of their thing full time but have to have a job on the side. And like, I actually really loved those couple of years when I wasn't doing it full time, because it took a lot of pressure off my thing and I wasn't really in a place where I was ready to like give it 100% of my time. I just met lots of cool people that weren't in music and were just outside of my circles, and so no regrets from that time. I was probably frustrated at the time. I would have loved to be doing more music, and I was probably a little bit frustrated about the pace of it at that point, but like looking back, I'm just like very like everything happens for a reason about that whole time.
Well, I think it's like one of my questions I always say on this is like, what is your advice for people who are wanting to get to a position similar to where you are? And one of the things that pretty much everyone says is like, make your own opportunities and like network with people and do the things you want to do on the local enough and small enough level that it is. So whether that's like, I want to be a music journalist, well, make your own music magazine, or like find one like through a friend of a friend and start writing for them. And I guess your local one was, I worked somewhere and they needed a gig, so I'm going to put on gigs, and through putting on gigs I met bandmates and now they're in my band, and that's kind of it. There's a lot to say about people like that, because I think it shows a really true work ethic and people who are really like, they really want it because they're willing to do kind of anything to get there. And people who I have spoken to who have that really like organic growth and networking skill is people who are now like really excelling. And it's really nice to see when you hear that it comes from something as innocent as, I was just putting on gigs and they were doing really well. I think it's really nice.
Yeah, I think it's important. And I think so much of like what drives me and the people around me and the people I like have chosen as friends and people to work with, like there is such a DIY culture that runs through all of it. And that's just like all I know. Like I have like a manager and like a very small team, but I don't really feel like I'm like in the music industry. And I always feel like I'm kind of on the periphery of it, like very happily so. Again, I mean, I think that's almost, you know, the same could be said for Dodie, even though we're playing these big shows. Like Dodie's not on a big label, or, you know, she's still funding and doing everything herself. And so there are like, there are levels to that. But I think the culture that I know and love is definitely like a very DIY, get your sleeves up and just like do it kind of way, you know. And that's how the tour we went on was, and like that's the choice. It's like at the beginning of a career, it's not a choice, you just have to do. But I think, you know, I think being unsigned or being kind of DIY or like very hands-on with your own project, like there comes a point where it is choice, and I would definitely keep choosing it.
Yeah, 100%. I know it's something we've spoken about before, but to anyone listening to this, the reason for then being an unsigned artist versus going to a major label to release a debut album, because obviously I mentioned before, like Patreon plays a big part in like your project, and the Secret Demo Club is like a big part of what you do, and like releasing monthly demos, like I'm a part of it. I think it's great. I love listening to your little voice memos that you do like monthly and like hearing what you get up to. And I was actually talking to my boyfriend about it the other day and like telling him how you operate, and he was like, I've never heard of that. And I was like, it's because I don't know many people who do operate like that. And it's obviously a choice that you've made. Can you maybe talk a bit more about why that was a choice?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, like I said, I think being unsigned when you have an artist project is like the default at the beginning, and it's still something to be proud about. But I think once you reach a level or get an offer basically of actually signing a more traditional record deal, and I guess say no to that, I feel like that's the point in which maybe it becomes a choice or more of like a conscious thing. And I was flirting with the idea of signing a just regular old record deal in advance of my album the year before. That's the first time really in 2020 that I ever saw like a record deal. I never see, like I know how they work, I thought I knew how they worked, but I never seen the piece of paper with it and like read through it and like digested it. I was just like shocked at how unartist friendly it was. I knew that kind of would be the case, but like the true extent of it was so scary. And I at that point had the bones of my audience and had built that for like 7 or 8 years, and I just couldn't grapple with the idea of anyone else taking credit for that or kind of messing with it. I would never say never, but I just thought for a debut I didn't want it to be watered down by any like A&Ring or like other voices. I just wanted it to be like undiluted me, and I just don't want to be like babysat or forced into a corner with any of it. But it wasn't like necessarily a no-brainer. Like I think there's labels still have a place, and like them labels taking the financial risk for anything is the pull, you know. They're essentially banks. I mean, there are good people that work at labels. You can have really lovely teams, you can have really awful teams as well, but essentially they, you know, fund your music videos, plug the gap in the tour support, all of that stuff. I've never judged anyone that signed it. It's so easy to get like quite purist and kind of like self-righteous about it, but because of the Patreon alone. I was in a position where I could plug those gaps myself. Without that, my hands would have been tied. There was no way I would have been able to do an album without Patreon. So because I did have that, I was basically like, I'm going to try an album campaign and everything around it where I am the label and I plug the gap. And if there's a tour support that needs to be injected into a tour because otherwise you're gonna lose money, that has to come from me. Yeah, and I definitely me and my manager Claire did not really sleep at all for the last year and a half. It was so much work mopping up all the jobs that other people would have done, but I think we felt so proud of it at the end, and the payoff that we felt on the release week and how much of that we got to have for ourselves was so nice. And the charting thing was just a random bonus. I didn't think I had a chance. That was just a complete afterthought, and all that stuff means a lot more to Claire than it does to me. But on the day where we did find out about that, and we went to Claire's local pub with Claire's really crazy dog, it's so loud, and her friend had ordered champagne to the table for Claire. And I was just this is so sick, because this is just Claire's moment. There's no other manager who gets to take credit for this.
Yeah.
There's no big label that gets to take credit for this. And also everything is relative. This feels like a huge success because we did it independently. A bit graduating from primary school to secondary school, the exact same units that we shifted and chart positions we got and tickets we sold in a major label scenario is actually suddenly not that impressive. But the same numbers, you know, the context is important. And so that was also something that was quite nice. It's not absolutely mind-blowing Billie Eilish levels of insane success, but it was given the way that we did it, it felt to us, it was our own version of that. So yeah, it's definitely not for the faint of heart, but I think it was the right thing for me to do.
Yeah, 100%. And I think when I saw you were doing it independently, I was sick. That's so cool. And anyone I've spoken to who has known a little bit about your journey, a lot of people have assumed, oh, who's she signed with? And if I've gone, she's not, they're like, what? She got a top 10 album without a signing? I'm like, yeah, her and Claire basically smashed it out themselves. And everyone is always what the heck? And I'm like, yeah, it's really cool. Oh. I think it goes to show though, obviously it's not my area of expertise. And again, as you said, people who sign record deals, there's no issue. There is no problem with people who sign record deals.
Not at all.
And it's an area of the music industry that I do not know much about at all. And I have never looked through a contract and I do not know anything about that. I just think it goes to show, and it's really exciting when you do go, oh, and we did it, do it independently. And I know a lot of people who have a lot of respect for you as well, who I've spoken to and have gone, what all has done is so sick.
That's so nice.
And we could never have done that. That's why we signed a record deal. And I just think it's quite warming when people say that, because you're like, wow, yeah, I get, obviously I know it's great, but it's really cool when you hear someone go, yeah, we could never have done that.
Oh, on the contrary, I think anyone could, I would say. I will say the Patreon thing helps massively, and nurturing that and putting time into that and building a certain kind of audience, a very kind of quality over quantity audience, I would say.
Yeah, 100%.
I think that is obviously a graph that I've just been sort of doing in the background for the last couple of years, but I really do think anyone can.
Yeah.
The money side of it is a whole, you know, being able to take that risk is such a privilege, and I don't ever want to assume that anyone else has that. But I also, yeah, I think the idea of trusting your gut and not needing to be A&R, and I do think that there's a lot of artists that can do that, but it's, yeah, there's don't get me wrong, there's loads of days where I'm God, I wish this was someone else's money. Yeah. You know,
well, it's we were talking about with American visas and how people are desperate for you to come out and play in the States, and we've spoken about it before, and you're like, yo, if someone wants to pay for my visa, I'll come. But
totally.
Obviously the benefit of being on a label is that a lot of that cost is absorbed by someone else, and that, you know, you don't have to front the cost of how much is a visa to get to America.
Oh my god, yeah, seven grand ahead, maybe 6-7 grand ahead for the whole band and crew. Mental. Yeah,
insane. So it's, you know, the cost absorption is very different.
Yeah, that's something I have to keep in check.
Yeah,
it's something I have to keep in check, and I feel very I feel very passionately about trying to give myself the same or a similar experience than I was on a label, because I think the point at which I'm going to get resentful is the point at which I have to make massive sacrifices because I can't afford, and that's what I'm trying to avoid, I guess, is you know, with the album. Even the creative side of it, I tried not to cut too many corners. There's inevitable corners that needed to be cut, but I tried not to compromise too much creatively, because I'm that's the point in which you get resentful for being unsigned. And down the line, if I find that I'm getting like music video ideas that are like more ambitious than I can afford, or there's like creatively something I really want to do, or a place I want to tour that I just genuinely can't, like, of course I would consider the idea of like a deal. It's not like a never say never thing, but for this cycle, I was happy to just taper my expectations a bit and try my best.
No, I think it's important, and it's nice to hear as well. I think it's quite refreshing when you only ever really see the same people doing the same thing and the same people turning out the same stuff. When you hear someone be like, "Oh, actually, we did it differently, and this is how we did it." It's interesting to hear a different point of view. And I think to anyone listening to this who is an unsigned artist, who is at very much at the beginning, I've become newly addicted to TikTok again, and I see people constantly like releasing stuff and saying that they're completely independent. And I think there's a lot of people who feel really beaten down and bogged down that it will never happen for them. And this is an example that you can do it. Like, you can release a debut, you just have to work even harder, because it's an even smaller team. But in terms of you saying about creative and like not cutting corners, I think your creative is some of the strongest as an artist that like I, as a creative, have ever seen in a release. Like, your music videos, obviously you work really closely with Greta Isaac on stuff, and Greta's amazing. But the creative is really good and really strong. I've always thought that.
Yeah, Greta Isaac, you know her, like, literally love my life. She's incredible and creative directed all the visuals on the album. I just made it fun. Like, I always thought visuals and music videos are such an afterthought to music, and I like used to kind of hate them. And then Gret is like both a visual artist and a music artist, so she just gets like all side of it, and she's just the best. And yeah, it was a lot of like cutting corners and pulling favors, and like, again, kind of like with me and Claire, like, me and Gret were like mopping up all the production roles of the music videos because we couldn't afford a producer, and like, it was chaotic trying to run around and get all these like niche props. Like, it was getting, shit got really weird. Again, I feel so like proud of what we did, and maybe double proud for the fact that there, you know, was like 3 or 4 crew on some of the music videos. Like, so yeah, but without her, I have no idea how we would have done that. Like, she's just the best.
What is your pinch me moment? Like, what has been the best pinch me moment that you have experienced in your time as a musician, whether that is sessioning for Diddy, whether that is on your own project? What has been the thing that sticks out when I say, what's your pinch me moment?
Yeah, some of the shows on this Dirty Run have been amazing. Like, the New York show is probably the biggest, and that was like really beautiful, and the venue is amazing. But I actually think, really, even though we spoke about it right at the top, I think that Latitude set was so special, because it was like gigging for the first time again, because there'd been such a gap, and it was so hard to realize how much I missed it until I did. And up until just starting to sing, I had no idea that I had missed it that much, and I felt like I was just so at home. On this stage, I never played out with the TM passing me guitars I'd never met. Like, there were so many like parts of it that shouldn't have been comfortable, and yet it was like incredibly comfortable. And one of those moments where I'm like, this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. I'm glad I stuck this out over lockdown, because a lot of musicians didn't, and I totally get why they didn't. And a lot of people in touring didn't, and I totally get why they didn't. But it was just very reassuring to like have that rush of feelings and like adrenaline again, and being like, oh yes, like, finally, you know, it's like still there, still got it. I think something about that Latitude was out was just really just high emotions for me because of the gap that was before.
If you did enjoy this episode, please make sure to rate and subscribe, and ensure to share with your friends and post on Instagram. It's really lovely to see when you guys are listening to these episodes rather than just seeing random numbers on streaming sites. So I really hope you enjoyed listening to this. And as always, we'll be back next week with another beautiful guest.